Well, this evening is our the first of our series this semester. This is our sixth year that we have been running this course. It's White House Communications Operations this year. And we've most years it's been that, but there have been some years when we've done the Press President and Democratic Society and then also White House Press Corps. But we managed to get all of those elements in whenever I run it, where we work on pulling those elements together. The idea of the course is that the relationship between the White House and the press is a crucial relationship. It's a crucial relationship for us as citizens, because what a president does has an enormous impact on our lives and really lives around the world. And the way that he communicates to the public is through the press. And so that relationship is important for us to understand in a lot of different ways, including in both sides how people do their work and how they view their work. And one of the things that I think comes through in both sides, whether we're dealing with White House officials or reporters, people are devoted to their work, see it as public service. It's certainly, whether it's reporting or working in a White House, one does not get a lot of money for what one does, but there is a great deal of satisfaction in the work. And so I want to give all of you an idea of how our guests got to the positions they did, what it is they do, and how did they get there, and what do they think of their work, and what do they see of the president. And of a White House, and how they view the relationship. Jay McMichael has worked at CNN since when did you start?
1989.
And he is a photojournalist who you can see his camera. How much does that camera weigh?
This weighs about 35 pounds.
And I bet it's, well, we'll talk about how different it is from when you started and what you can get now that
yes.
you couldn't get then.
Correct.
One of, Jay is an award-winning, he's won many awards for his video, including the video that he probably is most well known for is the shots that he took of President Clinton working a rope line and coming upon Monica Lewinsky. And that played probably in the millions, the number of times that one played.
And I didn't get paid extra. Just so everybody knows. Everybody asks, how much did you get paid for that? I got paid my hourly rate. So if I was a freelancer, I'd be a millionaire. So.
Wow. But you aren't, you aren't.
Gift's a big word.
Jay has been at the White House all of that time, but has covered a lot of different things because he's covered Hurricane Katrina, for example. And so you do a lot of things in part in covering the president. You do see the world. And that was true for Virginia, too, because Virginia, you took a lot of trips
in your radio years at
the White House. And Virginia has been at CNN. When did you get to CNN?
1996.
Because before that, she was doing radio in several different places, but also she'd been at the White House doing radio. And now she is in CNN headquarters in the control room. So she is in Washington as Jay is and has been for some while. So I think I'm going to ask them first to tell you about their work, and I want to know what it is you normally do. What is a day and a week like, and what kinds of things you're responsible for? And Jay, you want to start us off?
Sure. Well, if we're speaking about our schedule at the White House, as a camera crew, you have a lot of different responsibilities. We have reporters that we have to do live shots with, starting very early in the morning, around 5 in the morning, and they'll go as late as 10 p.m. at night. We also have...
Would that be in one day that you'd have to go from 5 to 10?
Sometimes.
Uh-huh.
It depends. We also cover the what we call the campus. We cover the West Wing. We have a stakeout position at the West Wing. So as VIPs come in and out of the West Wing, we can photograph them. We have a place out there where we can ask questions. We also cover the briefing room, which is where now Mr. Gibbs does his briefings. Sometimes the president comes in. And we also are responsible for photo opportunities, press conferences that the White House may be having, either in the Rose Garden or the South Lawn or the East Room, depending on where they want to set things up. So you have a variety of locations that we cover things, and it's just a matter of logistically being able to handle all of that during a day. The other responsibilities we have are when we're on the road, we are either what's called a pool crew, which is where where all of the different networks pool their resources and they share the video that comes out of that. So there's times when I'll fly on Air Force One, for example, with the president. There's only 13 press people on Air Force One at any given time. And those 13 people are responsible for disseminating information out to all of the different networks, all of the different wire services, the different magazines, anybody that is subscribed to the pool. So every fifth day, CNN will be responsible for Air Force One or traveling within that tight pool because we rotate with CBS, NBC, Fox, ABC. So just this past week, for example, I was with President Obama going to Elkton, Indiana, where we went, or actually it wasn't Indiana, it was wherever we went to the Caterpillar place. I guess it was Fort Myers. I don't know where it was.
No, it was Fort Myers.
We were someplace. It all runs together. It runs together.
Town halls, right.
And right. But anyway,
it was Caterpillar too.
He came back in the plane, and when he spoke, it was up to us. It was up to myself and my partner to get up and shoot what the president had to say. And there was a lot of news being made that day because Senator Greg had decided that he was not going to accept the commerce position. And there were a few conflicts of information. Gibbs was saying one thing, the president said another thing. And it all happened on the plane, and we were responsible for shooting that and then giving that out to the networks.
Did they tell you that the president was going to be coming back and would talk to reporters so that you had time? I mean, what do you need to do to get that thing operational?
Well, when you're on Air Force One, this basically sits at my feet, and if I'm shooting that day, some days I do audio. My audio guy will be sitting next to me, and, you know, they may give you a heads up that he's coming in the back, and they may not. And if they don't, you basically reach down, turn this thing on, get up, and then you're up. And everybody just sort of piles into the middle of the plane, and they get the best possible angle you can get. And he comes back, and then he speaks. And you better hope that everything works.
Yeah.
Because if it doesn't, it's like it never happened. Or the wires will have it, and there's no video, and then that's a big problem for us.
Has that ever happened to you?
Not to me. Uh-huh. Not to me. And it's a bad situation. If it happens, it's just the worst. Because you're responsible. It's the only video that's on the plane. There's nobody else shooting it. And so you're responsible for everybody's video. So there's a lot of responsibility with that. It's a fun job, but there's also a lot of responsibility. And so that's what happens basically in those situations. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, there's so many variables. There's so many things that happen at the White House. A lot of people will criticize that beat and say, oh, you're spoon-fed all your information. You only report what the White House gives you. But really, there's all sorts of opportunities to record history. You're recording history every day, and we take that responsibility very seriously. We're upholding the First Amendment, the freedom of press. We are constantly battling the White House on control over what they want us to see and what we want to push to see. And that is a constant struggle. Where we get frustrated sometimes is when as shooters, we'll feel like maybe our network or other networks may have decided to make a financial decision, and they won't push back as hard as they could have. And we think, you know, well, as a purist, we want to have just clean access. There'll be times where the White House might say, well, you can come in and take pictures of this, but no questions. And that's when we say, well, then we're not going to take a camera in there.
Well, they also tell you no sound. You can take pictures, but no sound.
Yeah, they try to do that, but we just don't accept that.
Has that been true in all administrations? Like, for example, have you had any cases of that in this administration?
We haven't really had it with the Obama administration yet. What we had the other night, which was interesting, was Hillary Clinton was departing to go overseas on her trip. Our photographer, Chris Turner, was out there, and out of nowhere, the State Department said, you can shoot Hillary going into the plane, but you can't shoot the luggage loading onto the plane. And we were like, why not? What's the problem? And now it automatically makes you think, why can't we shoot the luggage? And I'm out here shooting. If it's in front of my camera, I'm going to shoot it. And so there's always a struggle between what they want to control and what we want to shoot. And if you're a purist in terms of First Amendment, I guess, rights, you always want to push for total access. So.
Yeah. How many days a week do you work?
It depends. At the White House, if there's not a relief crew or another crew coming in, you'll work probably 12 to 14 hours in one day. If there's an overseas trip and it happens to be a long trip, you may work 14 days straight. It depends on the trip. It depends on, you know, Clinton. When Clinton used to go overseas, he would go overseas for long periods of time because he liked going to these countries. He'd never seen a lot of these countries. But he was like a sponge. He liked to learn everything he could about the countries. Bush, on the other hand, would fly in, fly out pretty quick. He just wanted to get his business done and get home.
Were you on the trip to Russia, to St. Petersburg, for the anniversary of St. Petersburg? It was the one where they had a celebration that Putin had a late celebration,
yeah,
and had fireworks and everything.
I was not on that trip.
I think it was midnight.
I wasn't on that one.
Yeah.
I've been over there before.
Bush was irritated that the celebration was going on so late. Yeah, I remember that issue about curiosity came up on that one. Virginia, tell us about your work.
Well, I I live in a box surrounded by lots of TV screens, and I consider my job more like an air traffic controller. I'm watching incoming feeds all day long, whether they're from the fence shot. We have guys, Jay's probably been on that duty too, to shoot the fence at the White House to see who's coming and going. And there's sometimes very revealing moments on that shot. So I'm watching that. I'm watching the stakeout shot. I'm watching our live shot location. I'm watching things that are happening on Capitol Hill. Last week, for example, we had cameras staked out where we were waiting for the arrival of all the bank CEOs to come and plead for their, you know, case, why, what they had done with the money from the first installment of the TARP. We also had, I came up with a line, on one side of the hall, they're talking about peanuts, and on the other side, they're talking about trillions. And it was two congressional hearings in the Rayburn House office building, just steps away from each other, where two major stories were going on. And one hits me, my son eats peanut butter sandwiches every single day. So I really cared about what was going on over there. And then the other one, I really cared about what was going on over there, too. But I'm watching all of this stuff. And when you're covering the White House, as Jay watches everything that goes on over there, there's nothing that happens in the world that doesn't eventually come to the White House door. Nothing. Whether it's Alex Rodriguez admitting to using steroids or, a calamity in some faraway place, the White House is always going to be asked about their opinion of it. So you have to kind of keep your eye on the world when you're covering the White House, because everything is fair game, I think. So, I mean, but what I do on a day-to-day basis is...
Now, how many screens are you watching, and how many places around Washington? do they represent?
It depends on what's happening. This week, for example, the Congress is gone and Obama's on the road, so I'm not watching a whole lot. But last week I had various hearings are coming in, stakeouts are coming in. I'm watching remote feeds. If, you know, when Blagojevich was testifying before the Illinois Assembly, yeah, sure. We were watching feeds from Chicago. I mean, where were they? What's the capital?
Springfield,
sorry. Yeah. But anyway, so you watch things like that that you know are happening over there, but eventually will come and land in your lap. So I am watching at least 8 TV screens at a time all day long that I can program whatever I want to watch. If I want to watch the House floor, the Senate floor, during the stimulus talks last week, I had to watch both. They were nearing a vote in the House, and the buildup was happening in the Senate, too. So you kind of have to keep an eye on things, because there might be moments that you're going to need to use for a reporter live shot, and the reporter can't watch all these things. They're trying to gather information on their own. So I'm looking for moments on the floor of wherever the action is to say, hey, do you want to use that as a soundbite in your next live shot?
So tell us about live shots and how many are there going to be during an hour, and what kinds of decisions do you make about them?
It's always news driven. If Obama's talking about, today's a perfect example. They're talking about the auto talks. You know, are the automobile companies going to be able to come up with a viability plan? They're also signing the stimulus bill today, and they're talking about foreclosure aid tomorrow. So what's your White House reporter going to report? All three of those topics?
In Afghanistan.
Well, that happened later.
Yeah.
It happened later this afternoon. So you have to figure out what the show wants, whether they can do it with a White House reporter, a Capitol Hill reporter, a State Department reporter, Pentagon, or whether it lands in the lap of a New York reporter that might be using sound from the Washington-based hearing that I'm sometimes emailing our stock market team, Susan Lisovich, or Alan Chernoff was doing a lot of the economic stuff. If I hear a soundbite that I think is particularly good, I'll transcribe it, send it out inside our bureau just so our people inside the D.C. bureau know what's going on, and then send it out to other people who might have a need for it. And we're not just talking about CNN TV, domestic TV. We're talking about headline news, CNN International. Our .com people are really tight on getting quotes on the air. So if they hear a great quote, they want to know it. And I'm like an air traffic controller. I'm listening, always listening for that next thing.
And who are you dealing with? You're dealing with the reporters that are at these various, at the stakeouts and the remote locations.
The shows that I cover, because I'm in the control room from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m., are shows that do not originate in D.C. They originate in Atlanta. And so the show teams in Atlanta will say, we want a White House reporter on this, and we want to hit the Hill reporter right after. This is what the White House is saying. This is how the Hill's reacting. So I've got Suzanne Malveaux, our morning person. I alert our team in the White House booth that, hey, I need a reporter. Let me know what elements he or she might need, and whether there's something, if you want a graphic to indicate, you know, if a graphic's going to help illustrate the story. When you're watching TV, look and see what they're putting on the screen, not just the talking head, but what are they putting on in a side panel to illustrate, you know, $787 billion, 35% for tax cuts or whatever the final percentage ended up being versus spending and this and that. I mean, that's the kind of stuff we do to help illustrate the story other than just showing a straight talking head. So anyway, the show team in Atlanta will say we need this and this. I'll contact either directly to the reporter if it's on the Hill or the White House producer and let them know. And then, you know, just keep an eye out for decent sound. And that's
if I can add to what she's saying, from our perspective, from a camera person's perspective, we're out on the North Lawn with a reporter. And there's a lot of pressure on Virginia because I'm out there just setting things up and making sure the light looks good and making sure my reporter looks good. The reporter will come out, and then I start hearing things like this. Hey, did you get from my reporter, hey, Virginia, were you able to get this sound bite? And she'll say, we're working on it. So I'm watching my reporter stand there
and not know
they're about to go live, and they have to act like everything's perfect.
and it's a matter of seconds sometimes.
And she's in the background jamming away, trying to get certain people to cut a certain bite or to get a certain graphic up. And if it doesn't go well, the reporter has to act like everything's okay. And then when everything isn't okay, I make sure we kill a microphone, and then that way the reporter can call Virginia, and then they can talk about it, however that conversation goes. But it's crazy to watch a reporter stand there and just have seconds go by, and they may or may not have what they need to make the shot go as smooth as they want. And it's up to her to coordinate that, and that's the part she's not really getting across to you guys.
And that's,
it's a lot of pressure.
That's also, I mean, I'm beholden to the people in Atlanta, for example, or sometimes if it's a D.C.-based show, it's the team in D.C. that's cutting that sound bite. How quickly can you process that sound? You got to transcribe it. You got to find time code, the in, the out cue. It's logistical stuff that needs to get done that I can't physically do myself. So it's definitely a team effort.
How quickly can that be done?
We have at CNN what's called a quick turn file. If it's one thing that's happening, if it's Obama about to get on that chopper and fly over to Andrews Air Force Base, I might be telling him, hey, Obama's coming out. Can I get that video? Because it may be the only video element I have of the day of, you know, Obama's hitting the road. How do you illustrate that? You show him getting in the chopper or getting off the chopper and climbing the stairs to the plane. And if it's happening at 9:55 and my reporter's hitting at 10 o'clock, I alert the quick turn people, make sure I get that. And they usually, I mean, 95% of the time, they'll get it. But there are live shots that happen where the reporter has begun, and I've warned them, I still don't have your sound bite. If I say Obama, then you know I've got it, so toss to it. But otherwise, I mean, can you imagine flying on the seat of your pants and it's your face on TV? We understand the enormous pressure that's on our reporters, so we try to maximize the potential for success. And, you know, if the soundbite doesn't make it, you move on. And your reporters are smart enough and they know their material well enough to just barrel through and get through it. And hopefully it'll be there the next time.
When Lyndon Johnson was president, it took 6 hours to go live. And so, you know, you had just such an entirely different kind of situation. So things had to be set up. You'll remember the time that now there are fiber optic cables in the White House, and it's much easier to do your camera work from say the East Room, whereas even during the Clinton administration,
right,
you had to lay cable, which required plugging in cables that near where the stakeout is. You know what? When you see a picture of the West Wing with the Marine, and then there's some microphones there where people come out and you know, if they've been visitors with the president, and they come out and talk about what the president said to them. Near there is a big box that you can plug in things, because the electrical system at the White House would not be able to handle all of the equipment that you all have. So even up until the latter part of the Clinton administration, you had to plug in cables, and then they rolled them down underneath the North Portico, and then had to toss them up on
past
a terrace.
The kitchen.
Huh?
Past the kitchen, past the florist.
I was going to say past the flowers, yeah. And then knot them, throw them up on the terrace by the east side of the East Room, and then there was a metal slot in one of the French doors that you pulled the cables in through, and then people would plug in their cameras. So it was a far more complicated thing than it is now. Now they can go live very very quickly, and so you because they've recabled the White House and upgraded it. Although, you know, as upgraded as everything is, when the Obama people came in, they came in the afternoon on Inauguration Day, and people couldn't get into their computers. I think they finally got into their computers sometime later the next day, and it wasn't that day. And then they had trouble with the whole sound system. They couldn't get the sound system to work. So down in the basement of the press room where CNN is, you have the overhead PA system. and that didn't work until Thursday. And it just seemed like one glitch after another, and that thing has just kind of faded in and out from time to time in the time that they've been there.
Isn't that WACA, though? I mean, that's unusual.
It is, yeah, and I'm not sure why, but anyway, they did have trouble with it. Mm-hmm. Well, how many days do you work a week? And
I work
kind of
five
how
days.
Does your schedule?
Well, my day begins with the DC Bureau call. That's the call that we hear from the various beats, our Justice Beat, our America Bureau, which covers anything that has to do with, you know, Guantanamo or Supreme Court.
How many beats are there?
Let's see, we've got White House, Hill, Pentagon, America Bureau, State Department.
Justice.
Mm-hmm. America Bureau incorporates Justice. So it's, well, I mean, there's more than that, but those are the ones that report on a daily basis. We just try to talk about what's coming up that day.
Who's in on the conversation?
Everybody that's got a decision-making role about this is what the shows are asking for, this is what the reporters are pitching, this is where we think the day is going to go, and this is, you know, where the ideas are circulated, so everybody's aware of what the others are doing. And then by the 10 o'clock call, they've actually conferred with Atlanta and New York, and they make some decisions about, you know, finalizing some plans, how they want to do this. So, you know, how to deploy our reporters. We don't have, you know, an unlimited supply of talent. We have to use our people wisely. So you don't want to start a reporter chasing that story and then by 2 o'clock say, oh, changed our mind, let's go there. Because that's a whole wasted day. So,
how many people, when you're assigning a reporter to something, you're assigning a whole crew. So how many people is that?
Well, you
is
would
it
have,
four?
I guess it depends. You would have your tape producer, someone who would help actually gather the editorial things. You might send out a field producer to go cover a news conference that becomes an element. The reporter may go out and do a different element. I don't know, but...
And you have the camera.
Sometimes it's just me. I mean, sometimes it's one guy or one girl.
Go to CNN.com and type in the word CNN.com/giving and see something that Jay shot all by himself. And did you interview all those people too?
Yes.
Down in Hamden?
Yes.
He did this phenomenal thing. Everybody at Cook Library, you will love this because it's Hamden at Christmas. CNN.com/giving. Check it out. He did it. It's awesome. And he shot it all. Did you edit it all also?
Shot it, edited, interviewed.
You will love it. It's so much fun.
But we like having reporters do the interviews, and we like having producers produce everything. And we would rather more people be involved, I think, sometimes. But the industry as a whole is shrinking responsibilities down, multiple responsibilities down to smaller and smaller groups of people. I know there's a local station in town now where the reporter is shooting, editing, and reporting everything on their own. And frankly, it doesn't look very good. But it's because of the economy being the way it is, right. a lot of the news business is shrinking down.
Sure.
So as students, it would be very smart on your part to learn nonlinear editing, Final Cut Pro, is what we use on our Macs. It would be good for you to learn how to shoot. If you want to, it would be good to work on all your writing and have all of those skills as tools to draw from. Because at some point, somebody's going to say, hey, listen, you know, this past campaign, for example, the past presidential campaign, I was on the McCain campaign. And we had a young guy working with us who was straight out of Georgetown. And he was very smart, and he had a little camera, and he would shoot on the campaign, and then he would throw it into a computer, and he would edit, and he would feed from an air card off the computer or from a Starbucks Wi-Fi, and he would basically do a lot of that stuff on his own. The quality wasn't quite as good as if...
Was it a flip camera?
No, but we used flip cameras during the inauguration.
Uh-huh.
And they're... pretty incredible.
Uh-huh.
And there's all, you know, I mean, the technology is shrinking a lot of the responsibilities to one person. So it's good, you know, if you're serious about being in the field of journalism, learn all these skills. Work on your writing, work on your shooting, work on your editing, because I guarantee you that's the way this business is going, and you would be smart to do that.
What are the changes that you've seen since you started at CNN? In the technology of what you can shoot, how quickly, and then the range of things that a president does. Have you noticed a difference in the public aspects of the presidency? Say, for example, if you went back, if you were we have a real old fart, and you went back to the Eisenhower administration. Eisenhower gave about, in his 8 years, he gave about 750 speeches. Mm-hmm. And a lot of those were not ones that were for television. I mean, most of them wouldn't have been. I mean, those would be things like in the Rose Garden, a group of farm officials comes through or small business people come through and they get some kind of award. Those would not have been on television. CNN comes on in 1981 at the White House. Fox and MSNBC start in 1996. When you look at the number of occasions that Clinton spoke, and most of those were available for CNN and later for Fox and MS, he, instead of 750 in his 8 years, he had 4,400. So the pressure on television, and television is what they aim for. The White Houses for a long period of time have regarded television as their way to the public. Particularly with cable, that they can be on for a whole speech. So it's not like just on the evening news where they have, you know, a minute to explain something. Instead, with cable, they get the opportunity to have their whole speech. Today, it wasn't just Obama who spoke. Biden spoke. Some guy with a solar outfit spoke. The governor of Colorado spoke. All of them. And CNN took it from beginning to end.
Well, I remember, I mean, I was at the White House when Marlon Fitzwater was press secretary, and were you there then? The briefing, the White House briefing, you could only record the first 5 minutes of the briefing. Mm-hmm. Everything else was on the record but off camera. So if you had a question and you needed that soundbite for that night's programming, you needed to be the one to ask it in the first 5 minutes. Robert Gibbs last week was having an hour and 15-minute long briefings, and every bit of it was recordable and airable, and it did for the most part. But, yeah. I mean, can you imagine today
if you try to
enforce that?
One of the things that I do is I write down how long a lot of aspects of the briefing. That briefing, the first row, there are seven rows of seven seats each in the White House press briefing room. And television, the first row you have CNN is in the first row, and NBC, ABC, CBS, AP, and Reuters, the two wire services, and then in the middle sits Helen Thomas. So Helen didn't ask any questions that day. So it was six people, and that first row questioned him for 33 minutes. He, out of that briefing, 33 minutes of it were from that front row. And I counted the people in the room, because it wasn't just the 49 people in the seats. There were another 40 people that were in the room. So out of that, the only people that, right there at the beginning, that got called on were those six people in the front row, and they were mostly television and the wires. And those are the real meat and potatoes of the White House. And you could see it when Obama decided he wanted to talk about his stimulus program, but he ended up having to talk about Daschle, that he spoke not to the New York Times or the Washington Post. He spoke to television, and he spoke in one day to all five networks.
But that was prearranged. That was prearranged.
Yeah.
I mean, back in Reagan's day, when Michael Deaver was over there, and even during Bush 1, they found a way to get around the big nets. They would invite, and this, because at the time I was working for a radio group, and so when the mayor of Salt Lake City or Kansas City, Missouri was invited to the White House, you know, we were there, and they would invite these local folks to the White House and get that kind of coverage. It would bubble up instead of, you know, trying to get the New York Times to cover something, or CNN or whomever, might not have been as successful as knowing that if you invite somebody from our local radio station listening area, you know we're going to come and we'll cover it. So they were very adept at figuring out how to bring, at the time there were lots of bureaus that had radio stations or TV stations all over the country. And it was just another way to get the message out without having to compete for the big networks time and airtime.
But now one of the things that's happened is that one bureau after another is closed.
Yep.
You look at the White House, the news organizations that no longer have seats there because they just don't have White House reporters. It is enormous. And so you've had bureaus go out of existence, like Newhouse. And the Cox Bureau is going out at the end of March. What are the implications for that of regional coverage? Because those are news organizations that covered regions. They covered states and localities. And what happens in particular, not so much at the White House, because I think the White House will always be covered, but what about Capitol Hill? What about members of Congress that from those areas? How do people back in California, for example, find out what their member is doing? And it's not just going to be maybe that they don't get television coverage, but it's the kind of investigative reporting that print has always done. And Are members of Congress going to get a pass that way because you just don't have those bureaus anymore? But what about television? What kind of alternate coverage is there for state and local level? Radio seems to be doing pretty well.
Well, you've got the internet. I mean, the internet has done a couple of things. It's killed newspapers because newspapers' content is on the internet for free. So we just had a conversation today with our president of CNN, Jim Walton, who spoke about how we will never put our shows like The Situation Room and Lou Dobbs and things like that on the internet because there's a premium for those shows. Cable carriers pay CNN a lot of money to provide content on cable. So what's happened with newspapers is they've sort of had issues because they've put their stuff out there for free on the internet, and there's no reason to buy the paper, and that's killed the paper. So where we're losing bureaus in the White House, we're also gaining different organizations in the White House, like Politico,
right,
and blogs. The blogs are coming in, and initially, you know, I used to call the blogs the bloggerazzi, because there were really no standards for their journalism. Where we tried to, CNN has a very strict standards and practices department. A blog could write hearsay. A blog could write virtually anything they wanted to. So politicians on the Hill now, they're not necessarily getting it passed because technology is morphing in a strange way where they don't even know how to handle that. CNN has really pushed the envelope on the Hill with things like cell phone cameras, where we've been in areas that theoretically, you know, in the past, we weren't supposed to have one of these cameras. If somebody shows up with one of these cameras, they will immediately push us back and say, well, you're supposed to be in this designated area, that designated area. But now we've been on the air a few times with a cell phone camera in areas where we weren't really supposed to be there, and they have no idea what to do with this. So in terms of the local coverage aspect of it, I think you're going to rely more on probably local blogs, things like that, to hold politicians accountable
Yeah, well, newspaper.
You know, but definitely, you're definitely losing the in-depth part of it with the newspapers.
Papers, yeah. And so somehow we have to figure out how newspapers can survive, because so much of what they do becomes a part of what television does. There are a lot of networks that take stuff from the New York Times, for example. I mean, you can just see an interesting story from the New York Times migrates very quickly to a network evening news. Some of the cables even sometimes will take something from the New York Times or the Washington Post, you know, a hot story that they have. I mean, you just take, for example, the story that the Washington Post had about Walter Reed, the Walter Reed Medical Center and the terrible treatment that that Iraq and in Afghanistan war veterans were getting. And that was, I think it was a three-part, two- or three-part series that was just staggering. And everybody took that. I mean, other newspapers took it. But how long did it take? It took 1 year. It took two reporters 1 year to do that story. And so a lot of resources have to go into the kind of work, the investigative work that newspapers do. And so we need to figure out some kind of model. Walter Isaacson in Time magazine was talking about doing it for pay, you know, having a model where you have to pay for content. And a couple of years ago, Tom Rosensteel, who was the head of the Pew Project for the Excellence in Journalism, and Mike McCurry spoke here in a session not last year, but the year before, at the end in May, and the two of them were thought the same thing, that ultimately it's just going to have to pay in order for news organizations to survive. But having healthy news organization is crucial for us all, because otherwise, how are we going to find out what is actually going on in government? Because in a representative system, you depend upon knowledgeable voters, people who are informed, and in order to have that, you certainly have to have news organizations that are functioning well.
Well, and it's vital too to a healthy democracy. You know, whenever you see a country that's been, well, say when Russia was under, when they had the revolution in Russia, the first thing that happens in a revolution is they immediately cut off the press, and one of the things that kept that revolution from keeping Yeltsin from getting overthrown was a lot of people were able to see CNN outside of their local Russian television. And what happened was the local Russian television had been shut down. But because everybody had satellite dishes at the time, they were able to see CNN and see what was actually going on. You know, and you have the checks and balances of the Constitution with the executive, legislative, and judicial branches. Really, the sort of intangible fourth check is the press, and we're able. Our one of our roles, not that it's an official role, but it's to really keep track of what's happening in those three branches and make sure that they're all doing things the way they're supposed to be doing them as well. So I think it's vital to a healthy democracy. It's the First Amendment is a very serious issue.
Keeping them honest is what we call it at CNN. And, you know, the idea that there would be a White House event where they would tell you going in, there will be no questions, fries me every time. Because you can tell us there will be no answers, but you can't tell us there will be no questions, because that's the only reason why we're here. If you don't want to answer the question, that's your prerogative. But if we're here, this is our job, and that's what we bring to the equation. So anytime I ever hear, no questions will be taken. Oh, really? No. Questions will be asked. No answers may be given. That's fine. But I just, and anyway, that's one of my pet peeves.
Well, that's a struggle that definitely takes place. And if a president does not come out, does not appear and answer questions from reporters, pressure builds up. And so then you have him say, come out. This happened with Clinton during the impeachment period, and he didn't want to answer questions. And so he would come out and make a statement of some sort in the Rose Garden. And he would have so many questions yelled at him, but he would turn around and go out and not answer the questions. but he certainly got them. And they would try other people answering the questions, but that's not the same as having the president answer questions. Well, let's take, speaking of questions, let's take some questions. The way we'll do it is we'll take a question from Towson and then a question from you guys.
No questions.
Okay, Towson.
Did you mention that Jay and I went to Towson?
Yes. Well, they've gotten your bio. I sent your bio. You both are. Not only you went there, you graduated.
Yay.
And I played football, and I graduated.
Woo-hoo.
Yeah. Last time we had a good football team there too.
Was Phil Albert there?
He was. Yes.
And you reported about the coach.
That was my first job. My first radio gig was to do the pregame show with Coach Albert. I learned a lot about football. On the job training, totally.
Okay.
Your undergraduate preparation at Towson helped you for your career. And what further education did you need, both formal and informal, to continue your profession?
Towson State back then had a great radio station, WCVT. I don't know if it's still there, but it was a bona fide radio station in the community. And when I decided, back then, I really liked sports. I loved baseball. I liked football. And there was a woman on TV back then, on WJZ-TV, named Andrea Kirby. And this was a long time ago. My dad told me, no, you'll go to Towson and major in accounting. But no, Dad, I want to be a teacher. No, you'll major in accounting. So then when I saw Andrea Kirby, I decided maybe I can get a job doing sports, because I had kept stats for my high school football and baseball teams. So I went to the station, and sure enough, all these guys said, sure, we'll let you play. And I joined the radio station there, and I learned what I needed to know, but I realized on graduation day that the education majors were fit to be teachers and the accounting majors were fit to be accountants, and I was fit to be nothing until I got my first job. So my education helped me get through a maturing period, but what I really needed was real life experience. And I got a lot of that when I was working in smaller markets where I could make mistakes, where people wouldn't hold it against me and hopefully not remember them. But really, truly, I think if what you want to do is report on the White House or whatever, what you need to do is study economics these days, find out how economies work.
History.
Study religion, because if you study and know what people believe in, you'll understand why they go to war. And history. And the English language. Know how to write. Be a writer. Trust your instincts. If it seems crazy to you or interesting to you, it probably is. Go for it. Learn whatever you can about how society works, how your own environment works. That's the best advice I'd give.
How many different radio groups did you work for? Because you worked in Delaware in addition.
Well, my first gig was in San Marcos, Texas, where they told me, I answered an ad in Broadcasting Magazine. They wanted a disc jockey sportscaster, and they hired me over the phone. I'm from Baltimore. I had never been to Texas. So they hired me over the phone, and I drove down there with my dad, and I'm, 22 years old, and that's where my football knowledge came in handy, because the Southwest Texas State University Bobcats went to the Division II playoffs. So football became major news, and it helped me. And so you can't underestimate whatever little things are part of your life, how they'll help you down the road. But from there, I didn't stay there very long. They told me nothing ever happens here. The first week I got there, a guy had tried to rob the local, it wasn't a Kmart, but it was like a Kmart. He took a shotgun, and he barricaded himself in the store, and the cops shot him dead. I'm like, whoa, I've been here a week, and I've got big city crime in this little town, So I look back on that experience. For 3 months I was there, but I interviewed a guy who was sent to death row for murdering a bartender. He went into a bar and he shot the bouncer, and it was the first murder trial I had ever covered. I think about these experiences now and I think, gosh, I only wish there was a change of venue case that involved some African-American kids who were picked up at like a campground environment, and they had to be taken over a river, and somehow the boys drowned. They were teenagers. And the white officers who were transporting them in something like a canoe were being charged. You know, what happened to these boys? Well, it turns out that they had been handcuffed. And when the boat tipped, they drowned. So it's like this change of venue case. And, you know, all of this happened to me in the first 3 months of being in this very, very small college town in just south of Austin, San Marcos, Texas. So I treasure that experience because it forced me to come completely out of my comfort zone. I knew nobody when I got there, and I really just had to make my bones. And then I got really, really homesick, and I came back up, and I DJ'd at WWTR 96 FM at Bethany Beach, where I was not a DJ. I couldn't tell you who played drums on that Led Zeppelin song. I didn't know that kind of stuff, and that's what you needed to know to work at that station. So I went back to news in Salisbury, Maryland, where I was still very young, but we won some awards. I got some AP awards back then. So that kind of made me realize how much I love the news. I love the news business. And then a job opened up in Washington at a place called Bonneville News, and they had stations in some of the major markets, not totally major, but I got to cover Bob Dole when he was majority leader, but not as majority leader, but as the senator from Kansas. And Richard Gephardt, when George Stephanopoulos was an aide to Richard Gephardt, Gephardt was in a St. Louis congressman. So those memories that I was, you know, the first interview I ever did when I got to D.C. was with Senator Nancy Kassebaum from Kansas about this new guy in the Soviet Union named Mikhail Gorbachev and what was her impression of him. And she was just a really terrific senator from Kansas, and she was a Republican. And the word about Nancy Kassebaum was, however Nancy goes, so goes the Senate. She was one of those middle-of-the-road Republicans that was kind of, you know, if you could read her, then you could figure out where the legislation was going. So I learned a lot covering Capitol Hill. Those memories and that experience still helps me to this day, because a lot of the people I covered that were young back then are still in office. So everybody thinks I know who everybody is in Congress. It's not that. It's just that I've been around long enough, and I see them. Yeah. But then when I worked for Group W, well, when I was at Bonneville, that was when the Iran-Contra hearings were going on, and we got this great, great drama in Congress with, you know, celebrities would show up to watch these congressional hearings, and it was just, you know, Oliver North. I don't know if any of you remember this. It's so long ago, and you guys were probably so little if you were even born then, but
they've
it was a really amazing, it was an amazing time in Washington back then, because you had Ronald Reagan, you had his Secretary of State saying, no, I don't speak for this administration. He was, you know, George Shultz was the Secretary of State who had, you know, done so many amazing things, and Caspar Weinberger and all these names. I just think there's a great book. Richard Ben Cramer wrote a book called What It Takes. It's this fat, and it's worth every single page. It's about the 1988 presidential election, and it talks about, you know, Bob Dole's struggle coming home, you know, wounded and broken, you know, from World War II. Richard Gephardt, whose father was a milk, you know, delivery guy, and Joe Biden was running in 88. Yeah. Dukakis, a Greek immigrant, you know, George Bush, Pete DuPont, all of these people were so sure that they were the ones that we needed in 1988. And he does a phenomenal job telling you about what it was in their upbringing that gave them the kind of confidence to go out and say, give me your money, because I'm going to be in charge of this country and the world, in effect, back then. And I've always, I'm really glad I read that book when I read it, because it helped helped me to understand what motivates these people. And Biden's been back time and again trying to run. But, you know, anyway. Yeah.
Jay?
I'm way off track. I'm sorry.
Well, when I went to Towson, I received a degree in mass communications, but I was also interested in film, so I took some film classes there, which really helped me with my shooting. because it was all about shot composition and sort of stretching the boundaries in your brain of what was an acceptable looking shot versus what wasn't. But I wanted to be on air as a sportscaster, and I was playing football at the time, and a guy named Keith Mills, who's on the radio now in Baltimore, used to be on the air at Channel 2, he took me in to do an internship at Channel 2 News, and I did the internship. I wanted to do sports. I ended up hanging out with the photographers the whole time, though, and they were the guys that really knew what was going on out in the field, and just had a great time with these guys, and the camaraderie was awesome. But in terms of my education, I think, you know, I think in terms of journalism, I think the one quality you really have to have to be a great journalist is you have to have a natural curiosity for what is going on around you. I heard Bob Schieffer say something great about Walter Cronkite and Dan Rather. He said if those two guys walked out of the building right now today and somebody got into a car accident out there, they'd be running around the car trying to figure out exactly how it happened, why it happened, who did what, and they still to this day are just incredibly curious people. And that really is what makes a good journalist, whether you're a camera person or a producer or a reporter. So the education side of things is important for journalism. I think having a communications degree, it makes you familiar with how the industry works. But I would really, if I was a journalist today coming through college, what I would do is concentrate on writing, and I would concentrate on, like Virginia said, on history, maybe even political science. Something where you have a specialty where
this
you
is
actually
a political science course.
Well, there you go. Where you were
in the right place.
I didn't know that. So there you have it. But something where your specialty can then translate to either a newspaper or a blog or television or radio, because you don't want to go on air not knowing what you're talking about. And so one of the things that makes people, like we have John King, for example. John King probably knows more people than anybody in the news business right now. He has a Rolodex that's incredible. And the other thing about journalism that is so important is developing relationships, maintaining those relationships, giving those people that you have relationships with the confidence that you're going to keep their information under wraps. And John does a phenomenal job of that. And, you know, I don't really know what his background was. He was a wire reporter for AP for a long time. And he started off working on local court cases in Boston. And he's a guy that is naturally curious and is voracious in his appetite for consuming information and being the first one to get it and also getting it right. And that is a big deal nowadays, especially with instant news. And we are instantaneous all the time.
Can I ask you a question about Hurricane Katrina?
Sure.
How did you all cover that? You were there, right?
Yeah.
And can you tell us what kind of how you designed the coverage? And Virginia, were you involved at all in sending people out?
I don't have the decision making authority on who to send and you know, how many troops to deploy to something like that. But I distinctly remember the day that Katrina was happening. I guess I've been around long enough because in our newsroom, I said, does anybody remember where George Bush the elder was when Hurricane Andrew hit? And that had happened in 1992. Mm-hmm. And George H.W. Bush was like a no-show on Hurricane Andrew when it was destroying Florida. And George W. Bush was in California at a very meaningful, laudable event honoring World War II veterans, but New Orleans was getting destroyed. And so the idea of he doesn't see the significance of this event because he's not here in D.C., let alone going to Louisiana, but he's not even here in D.C. when this is going on. I mean, I felt that right away, that this is going to be a problem for George W. Bush. But But you were on the ground there, so.
And when did you go?
I went in a day after it happened, and so we went down.
So it was Sunday or Monday?
I think it was a Monday, and I think basically the world in general probably didn't realize the severity of the storm until Jean Meserve went on the air that night, and she got on the phone and did what we call a phoner or a beeper, and they had been through a pretty harrowing experience, and the reality of what had happened was setting in with the flooding and the fact that the levees had broken and breached. And then Jean really brought it home with a very heartfelt, emotional report that night about people crying in the distance and dogs howling in the distance and just this, you know, and you couldn't get to these people, which sort of put all of us in a weird spot because when you're covering events like that, we're really not supposed to help anybody. And it becomes a very ethical, strange dilemma because you see people that are really hurting and really in trouble, and you have to start making decisions about how you handle that. And you get involved and help people. Probably that's not the best move, because that happened with a still photographer in Africa where he was shooting starving children with his still camera. He had given some food to one of the kids. Another photographer had gotten a picture of him him doing this. His company called, said, turn your cameras in and put a Red Cross vest on and go work for the Red Cross, because your job is not to do that. So you end up with this really tough.
What about calling? Is there any group that you call when they're like you come upon something, a group of people that like are on the roof and nobody has found them?
Well, our job is to report it.
Uh-huh.
In our business, we're supposed to report what we see. If we report it and then people respond to it, that's the best you can hope for. But what in terms of how we handled it, how I ended up down there at the airport, which was unbelievable. We showed up there. We were short of producers. And for the first couple of days, I was at the airport, and we were just covering this airport scene, which had turned into this community of people inside of the terminals of this airport. And they were just lined up everywhere. The stench was worse than any porta potty you could ever imagine, and it was all through the hallways, defecation, urine everywhere. It was incredible. Dead people laying on the ground in the hallways. At one point, we walked by a person who was alive, and then came back 10 minutes later, and that person was dead. And because these people were dying of just exhaustion and of just, I don't know what, but it was just
not being treated.
Yeah, just not being treated, and the stress was incredible. A few days into it, Bush showed up, and we were short producers, so they made me the White House transmission pool producer, which I had never done before, but I'd seen it done a million times, so okay. And they put me in the satellite truck, and I was responsible for transmitting Bush being seen on the ground in New Orleans to all the networks. The funny part about it was, or the sort of backstory to all that, was we were pulling up in our satellite truck, and the Secret Service was there. And you'll run into situations if you become a journalist with law enforcement all the time, and you have to be very careful about how you handle law enforcement. You need to be respectful of the law enforcement, but not take everything they say at face value, because they will handle you in a way where they just want to control what you're doing. But what happened to us there was we were trying to get the satellite truck out to the tarmac, and the Secret Service said, you're going to have to unload this entire satellite truck and this Suburban that was loaded for bear, basically. It was loaded to the gills with food and supplies and all this stuff that we had had to take down there. And they said, you're going to have to unload all this, and we're going to have to go through it all, and then you can go over there. And the president was going to land in 30 minutes. And I said, there's no way we can do that. And they said, well, that's what you have to do. And I said, I'll tell you what, then we're going to leave. And they said, you're going to what? I said, we're going to leave. I said, get in the truck, boys. And they got in the satellite truck, and I said, what's your name? And the guy gives me his name, and I said, well, when the president doesn't get on television in New Orleans live, I'll make sure that he knows your name. And I said, you have a dog. That dog can sniff these trucks. Do it. Make it happen that way. And so the guy said, okay, fine. And that's what we did. And the dog sniffed the truck, and we went in there a lot quicker than we should have. But just don't always take what they say at face value, because if it doesn't make sense, it doesn't make sense. And you need to do what you have to do to make things work. So you can sort of work things that way sometimes.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
But a lot of people don't pull a lot of people won't bluff them like that. But
that was the voice of experience. That was somebody who's been there, done that time and time again, and you knew the moment was depending on your business, what you were able to bring to the table. And that guy probably didn't realize that you were it.
No. But what happened, basically, logistically in New Orleans, I ended up with Soledad O'Brien for 2 weeks down there, and she and I did American Morning. And we worked literally 23-hour days. And for the first 11 days, I slept in a Buick down on Canal Street. CNN had brought in all these Winnebagos, and one of the problems with hurricanes that you run into are flat tires. You have debris everywhere. Literally, as we were driving away from the airport to get down into New Orleans, a car comes this way. We had, I think, NHK, Japanese news service, was in front of us. And we had security in front of us. And here comes this car out of nowhere. We're literally a quarter mile outside of the airport. And this car hits the back end of the NHK car, spins it around three times, and we have a complete auto collision. Well, there's no police. There's nobody around. There's no insurance companies. There's nothing. It's a free-for-all. Wow. They got out of the car. They looked at their car. They looked at their car. They said, there's nothing we can do, and we all drove off. There was nothing anybody could do. So the guy that hit the NHK car drove off, and then we drove off. We go down into the city, and it was a very bad security situation. We had the convention center, still had thousands and thousands of people in there, and we were getting all sorts of crazy stories out of the convention center that people were being murdered, and some of those stories
didn't turn out to be true,
but we were getting very weird, strange stories that were coming out of things. And the Superdome was still full of people. And so for the first 11 days, I slept in a Buick. We had a Winnebago. Soledad and some of our other producers slept in there. I didn't feel like having all of them complain about my snoring, so I stayed in a car by myself. But literally, for 23 hours out of every day, we would work. We slept about an hour each day because we would get up and do American Morning I'd have to get up at 3 a.m. in the morning, get out of the Buick, grab my gear, set up, hook up to a live truck, and shoot the entire American Morning show, usually handheld almost for the whole show. And Soledad would talk about everything that was going on. We would go through stores. We would go to different places, all these different things. And then as soon as that show was over, we had to go out and shoot. And we had to report what we were seeing. And we were gathering basically small vignettes for the next day's show. So I would end up shooting maybe four or five like mini pieces, like 1 minute pieces every day. And then we would get back. Soledad would write everything. She'd view all the videotape, write everything. We'd feed it all off to New York or Atlanta or whoever would take it. It would be about midnight in New Orleans, maybe 1 a.m. by the time all that was done. We'd fall asleep, get up at 3 a.m. and do it again, and we did this for 15 days. And that was crazy. And just, you know, you're up to your chest in water. We went into a house went in with a rescue worker who wasn't even a rescue worker. He was just a guy volunteering. And we were going down through a neighborhood, and we were told this police officer's family was in this house, and could we go check? So I'm on this boat with the New York Times, myself, and Soledad. And we float up to the house, right up to the window. And I'm wearing a pair of waders. and they break into the window and they call for the people that they think are in the house. And the New York Times still photographer, he says, I'm gonna go in. I said, could you please hold my camera? And I gave him my camera, and I went through the window first. And then I said, I'll take the camera. I took the camera, pushed the boat away, and then I went in through the house with the guy and the thing. So the New York Times didn't get in there until late. But what happens was, is that we go through the house, and there's a thing that happens with cameras. It's called distancing, where when you're shooting with one of these and you look through a viewfinder, it's like you're not really in a bad, like if you're in a bad situation, but you're looking through the viewfinder, it's as if you're watching it on television. And so it's this phenomenon called distancing. And it gives you sort of a false sense of security that you're not in as bad a place as you really are in. And but in this situation down there, we went into this house, and water was up to here. Everything in the house was floating, the furniture, the refrigerator. There was a dead animal floating around. I mean, it was everything you can think of was in this house. We walked in, and Nagin had told everybody, the mayor of New Orleans, go to your attic. That's the plan. And we start walking through the house. It was dark. The water was cold. I'm trying to shoot, and I'm feeling things hit me under the water, and they're bumping into me under the water. And this distancing thing was not working because I was feeling things. So we're going through the house. Stairs were down. The guy looks up in the attic. It's about 150 degrees in the attic. I'm afraid he's going to find somebody up there. Nobody's up there. But we end up going into the bedroom, and there, and this man had died in his bedroom, and he was floating in there. Mm-hmm. And that was really bad. So, you know, we came out, and we said, okay, there's a man in there. But there was nothing you could do. We had to just leave the house. They marked the house. They marked that there was a deceased person in the house. And then we moved on to the next house. And it just, and you would run into these sort of just strange, surreal situations. But, you know, your job as a journalist is not to get emotional about it, not to get too caught up with it. You're just trying to tell people that this is the tragedy that's happening around you. And there was a lot of that down there.
Yeah. Good question from here.
What kind of value do viewers get from the presentation of CNN as opposed to the Jim Lehrer NewsHour? So the graphics and the scroll at the bottom and the whole package.
Do you have a specific example that you're thinking of?
I'm thinking of...
Well, you get all the live events.
I'm thinking of the movement and the pace of the news on CNN when you're watching on TV, and the multiple news feeds that you're receiving when you're watching, and... you know, what role does the coloring play in the background as opposed to just a table and a conversation that's happening like with the Charlie Rose Show or the Jim Lehrer NewsHour? Mm. So what's the value to the viewer of that kind of presentation on CNN?
Like in the Situation Room where you see all those screens?
Yeah.
It's interesting. It holds your interest. It gives you a different perspective. It's always pushing the envelope of technology a little bit more forward. I don't know if it gives you more value as opposed to this one looks more interesting than just two talking heads. But, the Jim Lehrer show has a different format. They will spend 15 minutes with one person just talking, which is an entirely different format, and it depends on what your appetite is for news.
But also, CNN is all over the world, and so you're watching events live. And so they're giving the, they're going to give today, you could watch Obama from the Biden's beginning all the way to Obama at the end. And and you're going to have you've had a constant feed of that. You've had every day Robert Gibbs's briefing. So you're getting the raw news. You're getting the direct information that the newsmaker has to give, that the officials have to give, so their official explanation, and then you have other people coming in and doing commentary about it. But the value is is the news organization is a vehicle through which officials are providing information on what it is that that they're doing, and you're there watching the events themselves. I know when in the conflict in Lebanon with Israel that you had a couple, I don't know, 3 years ago or whatever, CNN was just all over the place, and so you actually watched it. And I know they took CNN in. I was in Hawaii at the time, and I was watching it at night. That CNN International was running, and so you watch the thing. So you get a lot of raw footage of events themselves and of people and what they're doing, and then you know you get the commentary and all the rest of it. You know, and whatever you know that. And some of it appeals to some people and not to others. But if you look at the election coverage, CNN was the leader on election night in its coverage. And I think that's the first time a cable had beat out the three networks.
It took a lot of brain power to make that night happen. And you know, it's exciting to be around people who are always thinking about the next best thing, not just about how to make what we know better. What's the next best thing? It's really great to be around people that think that way, that have that capacity for creativity. One of my favorite CNN moments, and this was long before I worked for them, I was on Clinton's first trip to Russia, and I'm in this hotel room in Moscow, and it's this beautiful hotel room, and I'm exhausted from the trip, and I turn on the TV, and there's CNN playing in my hotel room with the Lorena Bobbitt trial. Does the name Lorena Bobbitt mean anything to y'all? Like, what? I am in Moscow watching the Lorena Bobbitt trial, which is happening in Virginia. And this is the woman who had a little slice and dice with her husband. And it was a crazy, crazy time.
But I covered that trial.
Anyway. But it's no substitute.
Look it up.
You know, it's no substitute for, you know, Charlie Rose and the NewsHour obviously have an important place in explaining events, and you have that too, say on CNN on Sundays, Fareed Zakaria in his hour long program. I know he did one day during the campaign, he did almost an hour interview with Obama. So, you know, you have a large menu to pick from, and so fortunately, you know, it's in a lot of different places. Towson?
I got two questions for Jay, and you kind of already answered them, but I'll ask them anyway. When you basically said how you covered a lot of just disasters and just a lot of carnage, between like a man, your bio said you covered the Oklahoma City bombing. Is there any difference between a man-made disaster of like terror like that and a natural disaster like Hurricane Katrina, or you just look at it as the same way as you got to do your job and just move on and not really, you know, take in what's going on?
Well, you know, you're not a robot. I mean, you're a human. So in order to effectively gather news about a tragic situation, you have to be able to make yourself vulnerable to the human tragedy that's going on around you. And so you can't really illustrate that to your viewers and to the world if you don't at least drop the wall a little bit so you can deal with some of these things, because you won't be receptive to what is hurting people and what isn't. I think the biggest issue with a man-made disaster versus a natural disaster is a man-made disaster seems so much more personal and so much more almost insulting, because why would the question always goes through your brain, why would somebody do this, be it 9/11 or Oklahoma City bombing or just any type of thing like that. I think it's just difficult to understand why people do things that are so destructive sometimes. I think with a natural disaster, I know more of the feeling that I have when I'm in a natural disaster situation is wow, you know, nature is a very awesome thing, and it's incredible, and you just can't stop it.
The other part with a natural disaster that's very frustrating is you can't take a picture or an image big enough that really accurately shows what you're physically seeing yourself. I know during Hurricane Andrew, you were talking about that. I was down in Homestead for that. And
it looks like you're doing the disaster thing.
Yeah.
When you show up, everybody must increase their insurance.
The thing about that was that it's impossible to illustrate how from South Kendall Drive in Miami to the bottom of Homestead, every single thing that was in that area was flattened from this buzzsaw of a hurricane that went through
there. How far was that?
It was a 40-mile-wide wall, and it destroyed everything. And so that's the equivalent of going from Towson to where we are right now, and everything in between being leveled. So how do you show that? It's really incredible. You know, it's an incredible sort of a challenge. And that's a very frustrating part as a photographer, is to try and give accurate representation of what's going on. In Katrina, there was no way to really show actually how much flooding had actually occurred. It was an entire city was flooded. It was all underwater, everything that you could imagine, with the exception of this small section of the French Quarter. So how do you show that? And so we would get up in helicopters and do everything we could to give an idea to people how that type of thing happened. I will to answer your question real quick. One interesting thing, we went and covered the Clinton Memorial Service at Oklahoma City. It was a very tearful event. It was very sad. Everybody cried. And I remember I had young children at the time, and the thing that made Oklahoma City so awful, besides the fact that so many people were killed, was that so many children were killed, small children that were in a daycare. And that was a very tough thing for, I think, everybody to stomach. And I said to myself, walking into this memorial service, okay, I'm going to walk in there, and I'm going to just do my thing, and everything's going to be great. And the first thing that happens when I walked into the room was I looked over, and there's this woman sitting there. She had red hair. She was very notable. Everybody had taken pictures of her. She had two small sons, and they both were killed. And two teddy bears, two small sons, two pictures, and I was no good. I was losing it because I had about a 14-month-old at the time. And for me, that was very difficult, and I had to really get my act together and go cover this thing. And Ann Compton happened to be sitting next to me. And Ann Compton has four or five children. And I just remember her not getting emotional at all. And I was like, how do you do that, Ann? I don't understand. And she said, because I'm a professional. And I was like, man, I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing. But I really remember that, you know, because it just really struck me. It's a good question, though.
Ann Compton spoke a couple of years ago. She did the session, and she talked about being on Air Force One on September 11th. Mm. And she talked about going through the day. It's a really riveting account, because she was pool, and so she went through all the different places that there were, and that they went, and how they were getting information out. Because they went to so many different locations. I guess they went from Florida, then they, instead of going directly back to Washington, to Louisiana, to Oklahoma.
Oklahoma, yeah.
And she ended it by saying at the end of the day that she had a message from her son, one of her sons. And her sons, and she has a daughter, and I think three or four sons, and one of the sons called in and said that his classmate, and I think all the children brought their friends home, and so this was a child that she knew. So she said his message was that he had been killed in the World Trade Center, and she said she just sat and cried, and so she had held it in for the day, but that took her out. Okay, question here. I think we'll do one here, and then we'll do one back at Towson.
You guys were talking a little bit about blogs and the Internet's role in the future of journalism. And I'm just wondering, you know, as journalism students in the class, how can we maintain this standard of journalism that you guys put forward on the Internet? Because that's looking like where we're going to be going, as opposed to TV or print. So how can we maintain that journalistic standard that you guys got?
You mean for truth and justice for all and that sort of thing?
Well, it's just getting the facts. Like if you taking the Walter Reed, the pieces that the Washington Post did on Walter Reed, and how does one develop that kind of information? And it sure is going to be a challenge. Now, Jay was talking about some of the ways in which you can do it is people have turned into kind of one-man bands. And I could see that in the White House, and I sit in the basement of the press room, and there's a reporter near me. He was a print reporter who got a camera, and he has a flip camera as well. And so his reporting has really changed during the period he came up with George Bush, because he comes from Texas, and it was Ken Herman. And he does has a website on Cox News, on their website he has a blog, and so he does different kinds of stories that he puts there than things that he writes in the newspaper. And then he also with his video camera takes not just still pictures, but he's done video as well, and gives yet another dimension. And I've been surprised how rich his reporting is. There's so many different parts to it that I suspect a lot of the reporting is going to move in that direction. For example, he did a piece on being a pool. What did it mean to be a pool reporter? That was a really interesting piece on Air Force One. And I had not seen the interior of Air Force One. And then he went around and talked to people. But he also showed what you see as a pool reporter as you're going through a town and as you're following the president. How much do you really get to see? Which on this particular trip was not a lot. which was why he was doing it. But what do you all think some of the characteristics of reporting are going to be? Now, say CNN is profitable.
We have just started, and I think it incorporates everything. We have just started having some of our producers on Capitol Hill, for example, taking still photos, holding up a camera and taking the photos of the reporters waiting by the so-called Ohio clock stakeout on Capitol Hill, where they come outside of the Senate chamber and speak. So that's something we can put on our website to say, this is Dana Bash, our senior Capitol Hill correspondent, waiting for Senator Reid to come out and the Republicans to come out. So you've got still photography that's being incorporated more and more in CNN as well. But I just think always looking for not just what they're telling you, but why they're telling you something, that has to be always part of the equation. Because getting people to tell you things they don't really want to tell you is the true genius of being a good reporter. Anybody can just get a soundbite out there. But why are they telling you what they're telling you? How vociferous are they in their opposition? Is this just for show or is it for real? Always finding the other angle, the other side. Maybe there's more than one side. I mean, the stimulus debate was a perfect example of that. You had some Democrats just as opposed to how the bill was taking shape as the Republicans were, because their own little fiefdoms were being threatened. I just think using your own curiosity, sticking to your beliefs as far as trying to get what you believe to be the truth or what you perceive to be the truth, and then finding somebody else who might contradict it and find out what the rest of the story is.
You asked about, you know, how do you maintain a standard. One of the things, the standard of who, what, when, why, where should never change, regardless of what the platform is that you're using to get the story out on. be it the internet or radio or whatever, whatever it is, Facebook, you know, Twitter, right? There's all these different things that are coming around now that we use all the time. I use this all the time and upload photographs to Facebook. And I've uploaded photographs quicker to Facebook than AP gets. You know, so like I can sit here and go, okay, I'm going to, you know, take a picture of you guys. Now I'm going to put that on my Facebook page, right, and say this is what I'm doing. But my point is just simply this. Your standard for accuracy and your standard for, for getting things correct is vital. Because when people start throwing things at you like, well, you're biased, you lean this way, or you lean that way, the only thing that can counteract a bias charge is facts. And if you say, this is a fact, and you can prove that's a fact, nobody can accuse you of being biased. And, you know, I tell people all the time, Fox leans right, MS leans left. People will sometimes accuse CNN of leaning left. But I know this, we get hate mail from both sides. And if you're a journalist and you're getting hate mail from both sides, you're probably doing your job right. Because that means that you are accurately reporting something and you're not making anybody really happy with it. You're just giving the facts and you're not being swayed either way. And what Virginia says is true. You want to get what somebody says in front of you, take that information in, but then you want to get, you know, who opposes that, who contradicts that. And the truth is usually right down the middle somewhere. But in terms of like a production standard, if you want to go with that standard, a one-man situation is going to compromise certain standards of quality. Certain standards of quality are going to suffer. If you're talking about a really slick production, it almost always is going to take a few people. Like what Martha said with this gentleman that was doing this other report where he was doing all the different things, I'd say the quality, the production value will suffer a little bit. So that standard will drop some as you go to fewer and fewer people. So really, journalism is about the information, really. The whiz-bang stuff that we do for Situation Room and Election Night, that's really to keep you watching. That's to keep you interested. I think one thing that CNN does a very good job of with the whiz-bang stuff is giving information in a way that might normally be dry and showing it in an interesting way, like John King with the magic wall, that type of stuff. It's just showing you, it's a way of giving you information that might be graphically more discernible as opposed to just someone telling it to you.
Google, we used Google Earth the other day with a plane in upstate New York. I don't know if it was a real estate website or where it was exactly, but you saw on screen the house that had been flattened before when it was in its entirety. It was kind of creepy almost to know that there were real people living in that house and now that thing is gone. But that's another.
That's cool. It is Google Earth. That's what it is. I mean, you can move it around. Like I was asking one day. I was talking to somebody in the lower press office about a basketball court. This was when the Bush was still there, and they were talking about Obama playing basketball. And so I said, "Well, he'll need to build a basketball court. And where is it going to be?" And so, the guy in lower press said, "There's already one. It's a half court." But I said, there is? Where is it? And he said, oh, I'll show it to you. And so he went on Google Earth, and it was just unbelievable how you can see the whole White House compound. And you could see where that where it was. So then I went home and was doing it. And then I was moving it further, and so I'm moving it to my street. And there was my house. And and so I guess what they've done for a lot of areas is they've had people go up and down the street and take pictures. And so in that case with the plane crash, I remember seeing it. So there's an enormous amount of technology out there. Well, we've run over. I'm sorry. So we don't have have time for anything else. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Martha.
Appreciate
thank
it.
You.
Thank you, Towson.
Towson.
Go Tigers.
Thank you. That's so interesting.